In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars, because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. History isn't just the list of dates we learn in school or the objects that we see in museums. According to public historian Greg Jenner, it completely surrounds us in our day-to-day lives. And in his new book, You Are History, Greg explores this idea, covering daily life in the past from the delightful to the downright deadly. As consultant to the children's TV show Horrible Histories and the host of the popular BBC podcast You're Dead to Me, Greg has plenty of experience of making history both daft and enjoyable. And so David Musgrove began by asking him a seemingly obvious question. How exactly do you get children interested in the past?
Well, I'm not the font of all knowledge. I'm not an expert in this. There are many ways. The way that I tend to work, obviously, is I use humour. I try and write in either the first person or the second person. So either I write about me and I say I, or I'll say you to try and generalise to the reader. Jokes, humour, pop culture references are all helpful because they can make the unfamiliar familiar, because you can use analogy. You know, if you're doing jokes about something, often it's analogous. Often you're setting up a comparison or a simile, you know, someone's a bit like this. And we did that a lot in Horrible Histories. You know, we did a Cleopatra song where we made it pretty overt that Cleopatra and Lady Gaga have a lot in common. You know, these sort of extraordinary women who are fashion icons, whose boyfriends would die in their music videos / in real life. And so sometimes it's quite helpful to just find a hook that you can hang something on, because it then feels less scary and intimidating, and you can then deliver the information, which is the new thing, in a packaging that is comfortable. So, you know, whether that's a MasterChef parody or you're doing a YouTube makeover show or a TikTok parody, or you're doing something, you know, what it's like to be on Insta when you're 10 years old or whatever. It's all these sort of familiar things that suddenly feel safe. And then once they're safe, then children can laugh and enjoy them. And then your information is sort of not having to battle. It's sort of gliding into the brain quite easily. And so we do a lot of that on Horrible Histories. And I've sort of taken that into my podcasting, into my books, is trying to find a way to make it feel like it's relevant and it's accessible and it's familiar. Because the information, of course, is going to be the opposite. The information is new, and sometimes it's bewilderingly new. It's, you know, civilizations you've never heard of, societies from the other side of the planet, you know, people living thousands of years ago. So totally new, which means you need to have some way in. And sometimes that's as simple as saying, you know, your older brother smells, you know, and you know, toilets are embarrassing. And sometimes it's, you know, a bit more sophisticated than that, and talking about, you know, what it is that we do in our daily life, or what we do, you know, in our year as we get older and grow up. So I'm always just looking for something that feels like an anchor point that you can sort of hang, you know, you can stick your, what do they call when you climb a mountain, the little crampons or whatever, you stick them in the wall and then you sort of hang on. That's what I'm looking for.
I think that's an ice axe. I think your crampon is attached to your foot.
Thank you.
I think that would be a mistake.
Well, this is why I need an expert to help me on that. Ice axe will do. Thank you.
but I guess you can only take that familiarity so far, is it? Because as we famously know, the past is a foreign country, right?
They do things differently there.
Yeah.
They do. And that is the joy of horrible histories, of You're Dead to Me. The thing I enjoy so much about them is that they function on a sort of parallel, oxymoronic, kind of like two-way track of, on the one hand, you're pushing the, this is unfamiliar, this is foreign, this is weird, this is alien. And that's where you get your laughs. And on the other track, you're going the other way and you're stressing, these are people like us. They had problems too. They had the same experiences, probably. They had the same pressures. They had the same biology. You know, so if we're talking about the history of toilets or medicine or healthcare, you can say, yeah, look, everyone, whether, you know, doesn't matter where they're born or what era they're born into, everyone gets hungry, everyone gets tired and sleepy, everyone needs to, you know, go to the toilet. And so you can actually play on these two separate musical instruments during the course of an episode or writing a book. You can stress, people in the past were weird. They did this weird stuff. You won't believe what they did when the bubonic plague came. And then at the same time, you can say, but actually, we've all experienced something very scary recently in terms of, you know, devastating pandemics. And we knew what it was like to be scared and to be terrified. And you'd try anything to stay safe. So actually, the past being a foreign country is half of the battle. The other half is actually then twisting it and making history feel like a human experience.
Cool. Right. So we talked quite a lot about your previous work. Let's talk a little bit about the new book that you've done, You Are History.
Sure.
We've got a copy here. It's a fascinating, it's a really lovely book. It's really beautifully illustrated.
Yeah, it's lovely, yeah.
Who did the illustration?
Jenny Taylor. Jenny's a fantastic illustrator who was tasked with the almost impossible job of doing 300 sort of illustrations. Basically, it's 144 pages. There's like four different images on every page. It's so much colour and art. And all of it had to be historically accurate, of course. Yeah. So all the costumes, all the settings, everything's.
I guess you were checking that way.
Yeah, and poor Jenny would get emails from my editor sort of saying, Greg says the hats are wrong. So she did an amazing job. And yeah, it's beautifully produced. I'm so proud of it. I'm so, you know, it's so lovely when a book shows up and you go, oh, wow, it looks great.
Yeah, it's absolutely handsome and as I said, very pictorial. I guess the pictorial element was important to you.
Yeah.
Who is this for? What's the age range?
Probably sort of 7 to 12, but that's an enormous range. I mean, you meet a 7-year-old, you meet a 12-year-old, they haven't got a huge amount in common these days. But the hope is that a young child of 6, 7 is going to pick it up and enjoy the vibrancy of the jokes, the cartoons, the images. They'll feel, you know, safe enough to sort of flick through some pages. But actually, in terms of content, I'd hope that there are people, you know, in the early teens who are going to pick it up and go, oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting. And actually, I've had a lot of adults pick it up and go, I didn't know that either. So it's for children, but actually, I don't dumb it down. I'm not trying to patronize. The idea is to try and pitch it somewhere safely in the middle so that anyone can get something from it, but you're not leaving the kids behind.
Okay, so do the elevator pitch. What is it? What's the concept?
It's called You Are History, and it's 50 objects that a child will use every day on an average school day, assuming they go to school. Not all children do. And it's just a sort of day in the life. So it's same idea as my first book, which was called A Million Years in a Day. That was for adults. This is the same thing, but this is through objects rather than themes. So you start in the morning, you wake up in bed. It's the history of, you know, beds and alarm clocks, popping on your underpants, going to the loo, having a shower. It's all of the things you will do that day and the history of them. And those histories are often global because so much of what we have to do, I guess, as historians these days, is we have to make sure that people are understanding global history is important. We are interconnected. We can't just keep banging on about the Tudors all the time. We have to make sure that young people growing up are aware of the way in which the world has been shaped by all these enormous forces, by the movement of peoples, by trade and empire and colonialism and all these sort of big factors, but also the small things, the little things, you know, the history of toothbrushes and toilet paper and money and forks and spoons, you know, this stuff that is boring and irrelevant and you don't look at it twice. But actually, they're really interesting when you do look at them twice.
Yeah. So, and that leads us into a thing we were just talking about before we started the interview about how far sort of your work travels globally. So
yeah.
Obviously you're British, there's a lot of British stuff in here, but it's not exclusively a British history book in any way.
Not at all. It's, you know, this is a book that I wanted to make sure felt like it was universal and international, regardless of who's reading it. It's going to feel quite British because of my sense of humour. It's, you know, I'm looking at, there are stories in there from Korea and sort of Africa, Egypt, the Aztecs, Japan, China, you know, a bit of Germany, Renaissance Italy, the Inca, you know, obviously British history, Irish history, American, Canadian. It's a sort of all over the place, India, South Asia. It's, you know, you can't really do a British history anymore because actually our history is global history. And always has been. You know, we are all part of a big interconnected world. And we know this for, you know, historians have been working on this for a long time. But actually, it's not like, you know, we were all sort of sat in our little bunkers and then suddenly the world opened up to us. It, you know, it's been globalized for a long, long time. And so it's really important to do a book that is, I think, hopefully pointing out that the stuff that's in your kitchen cupboard or in your fridge or the stuff in your lounge at home or the things you might wear to school, they've come from somewhere. And often they haven't come from the sort of the history of your own nation. They've maybe come from a different part of the world. And that's exciting and fascinating and surprising, I think. And, you know, that's not the sort of history I grew up with when I was a kid. And so I thought it'd be quite nice to try and find that way in. And also, so many children growing up in the UK now have a family story that perhaps starts somewhere else or shared. You know, I did. I'm half French. So growing up as a kid, I wanted to know about my family's history. And I think it's just nice to be able to say to any child in the UK, pick up this book and you'll find something in there that probably resonates for you. And it doesn't matter where your parents or grandparents might be from, chances are there's something in there that's going to resonate. That's the hope.
Yeah, yeah. So it goes back to that familiarity thing you were talking about to start. Now, I suppose when we're talking about children and adults, I'm sure, the things that they are most interested in are things that they can relate to.
Yeah.
You know, if you go to Roman Villa, if you go to Chedworth Roman Villa, people always stop at the toilets bit at the start, where there's the little sign saying they use the sponge and stuff. I mean, those are the things that you remember, right? And
yeah.
That's kind of... You know, your book isn't just about bodily functions, but...
Oh, there's plenty of bodily functions, yeah.
That's what works for people, right?
It's fascinating, though. I mean, that's the human element. It's that we all have to go to the toilet. There have been 108 billion people, by the sort of best account, and every single one of them needed a poo at some point. It's just a human necessity. And until the robots come and replace us, that's forever the case. Toilets will be essential. And when you look at the history of, you know... The Indus civilization of South Asia in the Bronze Age, thousands of years ago, they had to get their toilets in order. That's, you know, that's the first thing that happens when you build a big city. You've got to have sanitation infrastructure. So the Romans, the Indus in ancient China, or you're looking at, you know, what the Tudors were trying to do. You look at Bazalgette in London in the 19th century. The building of sewers and toilets and facilities is really interesting because it gets into all sorts of questions about hygiene and sanitation, but also about gender and class. You know, who are you pooing next to? Are you pooing next to someone of the same gender as you? Are they the same age as you? Are they the same class as you? Is there a cubicle between you? No, you're a stranger. Okay, but you're gonna share this experience with them. Are you in the dark or are you lit and illuminated? What's on the walls behind you? All these little things can tell you quite a lot about society. And I think toilets are fascinating for that. And of course, being British, we're quite coy about toilets. We're quite embarrassed by them, which is why the laughter comes, because we're all a bit like, ooh. But children find it hilarious. So lean into it, you know, go with it. But actually, once you've done your obvious poo joke, then there's all this interesting stuff about what toilets can tell us about a society.
And I'm sort of, I hope that you're the sort of chap who is regularly inundated by questions from children who've listened
all
to
the
you
time.
Or watched your programs, read your books and stuff. Are most of the questions that you get about bodily functions, or what are the sort of the main themes that you get from children?
Well, the other book here, that's sort of very quickly, I sort of show off, it's called Ask a Historian, which is mostly for grown-ups or teenagers up, but that's exactly it. The book is based on questions I get from the public, and children often ask me brilliantly specific questions. Sometimes I can't answer them because they're too hard. Someone asked me, was Jesus sad about all the dinosaurs dying out? And I was like, great question. Don't know. Ask the Pope. Beyond my expertise. But often children are intrigued by the yucky and the gory and the small things. But then sometimes they ask really, really good questions. I did Cheltenham Book Fair quite recently, the festival there. Had a really lovely time. It was my first time talking about the book, and I was a bit nervous. And I sort of did the talk, and at the end there was 10 minutes spare. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll ask the audience if they've got anything they want to ask. And the microphone was working fine, but they didn't have microphones for people in the audience. So I couldn't hear the questions from the kids. So I came down off the stage because I had a head mic on, and I was able to go and see them up close and say, hey, how are you? And you know, get up close. And when you get up close to them, suddenly all their faces went, oh, this guy's come to have a chat. Let's fire all the questions we can think of. And from like sort of two sort of tentative hands in the air, suddenly there was just hundreds and hundreds of hands up because they realized that, I guess I was interested in hearing from them, and I was going to take it seriously, and I wasn't going to just sort of palm them off with a sort of pat answer. I was going to try and do my best. And suddenly they wanted to know everything, and it was great. And it really sort of startled me slightly, but actually then quite excited that, you know, the idea that, yeah, there is this passion and enthusiasm, but sometimes there's a little bit of distance between the historian on the stage, far away, and there you are, sat in the audience. And so they wanted to know about the history of red hair. You know, there was a young boy with red hair who said, you know, were people with red hair mocked in medieval times, or was it exciting to have red hair? And I was like, that's a great question. So children have they've got all manner of questions they want to ask, as do grown-ups. So often I get asked about the history of menstrual hygiene by predominantly women. That feels then perhaps as an interesting thing. Perhaps that's something that's not well talked about very often, and perhaps it's more so these days. But I think cleanliness, hygiene, washing, shampooing, brushing your teeth, these are the things that come up over and over and over whenever I ask people about their questions. And then obviously things like, is Downton Abbey accurate? I saw a movie, it said this, did that happen? Those sort of engagements with popular culture and dramatic storytelling or historical novels or video games. People want to know, is The Crown accurate? Did Diana really say that? That sort of thing also really comes up a lot. So I guess there's quite a lot of variety, but certainly young people seem particularly interested in bodily functions and in sort of etiquette and manners and decency and what they do with their bodies and what they wear. And that sort of stuff seems particularly important to them. They don't ask about Weimar Germany or, you know, they ask, who's your favourite king? And I always say, well, it depends what you mean, because Henry VII was the best king, but he was a monster. So that's always interesting. They always sort of ask, you know, they kind of a sort of top Trump style, like, you know, who would win in a battle between Henry VIII and Edward IV? You sort of go, that's a good question. I don't know. But I think the ordinary is actually quite fascinating.
What was the answer to the red hair question?
Well, I had to be quite careful because obviously the answer is quite saucy, quite rude, but there was a belief in European medieval health and hygiene that red hair might be a byproduct of people having sex during menstruation, and it could therefore be a bit of a problem. So I had to be quite cautious in answering that. That was at the Hay Festival, so that was, I think that was filmed. So my answer does exist somewhere, but... yeah, there is this sort of sense that I think that people go around with questions that they'd like to ask. And so the book, Ask a Historian, you know, which it came out in the pandemic and is just out on paperback now, that's me trying to tackle 50 of the most interesting ones. And I got 650, I think, that came in. And yeah, there is some bodily function, you know, the Bayeux tapestry. I know you've written a book on that. People wanted to know about the penises.
People always want to know about the penises.
They want to know about the penises. They want to know about how did knights poo in their armour. That is a, it's a basic question, isn't it? And yeah, on the one hand, you kind of go, gross. On the other hand, you go, yeah, but how do you poo in your arm? Do you just go and get someone else to clean it up? Or do you try and squat? So that, I think, you know, coming from horrible histories, bodily function and scatology humor is always going to be something that I'm comfortable talking about. And I think there'll be people listening thinking, oh, he's a bit childish. But I tend to find it's quite a good way to open people up to thinking about their bodies and the history of bodies and how important it is. If you think about the most, you know, I did a podcast on the history of ancient medicine, and our expert made a really interesting point. And she said that bad health was the norm in ancient Roman Greece. Good health was a rare thing because of the lack of antibiotics, because of the lack of modern medicine, so on. Most people were in pain most of the time from something, a broken leg that never healed properly, an ear infection, an eye infection. You know, there's always something. And suddenly you then look again at Julius Caesar's bust, and you look again at Cicero, or you look again at some of the sort of greats, Plato and Socrates, and think, they probably had a rash. They probably had a headache. Chances are their teeth hurt. And it sort of changes your understanding of them as these great people, as these sort of, you know, titans of history. You suddenly realize, actually, they probably went to bed in some discomfort and woke up in the morning going, oh, here we go. And it really, it changes your understanding, I think, to try and push the human element back in. So when people ask me about body stuff and scatology and whatever, I like that because it's, you can make a joke and it's great. But then you can start to talk about, yeah, actually, where did you go to the toilet and how comfortable was it? How safe were you and how often did you go? You know, what were you eating? What was your diet like? Were you getting enough vitamins? So were you constipated and in discomfort, or the opposite problem? Did you have the runs? What color was your wee? You know, because, you know, sometimes people would be diagnosticating through urine color. And so I think it's quite interesting to use the yucky and the gory and the icky to then ask the bigger questions.
And before we move on from that, I can't leave that one hanging. How do you go to the toilet in armor? What's the line there?
Well, I think it depends on the armor. And if you, I mean, I'm not a, you know, if you talk to a proper armor specialist, they'll tell you obviously armor differs at different times in history. But I think if you were sort of in a full, fully encased sort of 15th century style suit, I imagine it's quite difficult. And I reckon you probably have to take a couple of bits off and squat down, and you might need a squire. But I think in 12th or 13th century armor, where it's a bit more sort of some plate, but then some mail, some, you know, straps sort of hanging certain bits on, I think you might be able to adjust and lift and hoik and, you know, take out what you need to take out. So it depends on the century, probably. But if you talk to a proper expert, and they'll give you a proper answer, I'm sure.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So that constant churn of ideas, of new interpretations, of new approaches is fundamental to what historians do. That is what history is. History is a verb. It's a doing word. The past is what happened. History is the story of how we understand it. And they are unrelated in that sense. They're completely related in terms of what they are. They're both, you know, interested in the past. But history is something that's done now.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
So when you get all these questions and you answer them, are there any answers that tend to have elicit wide-eyed surprise from children? Is there anything that, well, that can't be right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my favourite one usually is just how many underpants was Tutankhamun buried with?
Mm-hmm. And the answer being?
145 spare pairs.
Clearly.
Which is just so many. It's just so it's so many or not enough. Because if you're going to live forever in the afterlife, you either need a billion pairs or you need one pair that can magically be clean and eternal. But 145, what's that about? I don't understand. So that one always, everyone in the crowd goes, what? The history of toilet paper, there's a really lovely advert from the 1930s I like to show, which has on it the tagline, now splinter free, which is sort of a sudden reminder you go, what do you mean now splinter free? What were they like before? And people are always surprised by ancient Bronze Age toilet seats from 3,500 years ago, and they look like modern toilet seats. They're startled sometimes by how different things could be, but how familiar things could be. You know, there's a really lovely thing called a fire clock, which was a medieval Chinese timekeeping device, which allowed you to smell the time rather than look at it. So each hour had a different smell. So it would burn through the incense, and after an hour had passed, a new incense would ignite, and that would smell different. So you could walk into a room and know what time it was by sensing it. And that's a really exciting idea, that you can tell the time with other parts of the body. And when you think about it again, that's a really good idea. Why don't we do that now? You know, I was late for this interview. I was early for this interview, wasn't I? I was an hour early because I forgot to put my watch back. I could have smelled the time and showed up on time. So, yeah, there are things that are sort of bankers. There are, you know, jokes that always work. Usually they're sort of toilet jokes, obviously. But there's other things, too, that are just surprising in slightly less interesting ways. You know, the history of the tin can, where that comes from. People are always like, really? You go, yeah, it was, you know, invented as part of a competition by Napoleon's France to try and get the army into the field because they were struggling to supply the troops with food. And it ends up being a British, you know, ends up in British production instead of French production because the scientists who sort of pioneered it, they couldn't get the copyright to work in France. So they hopped across the channel and secretly took it to the British instead. So the Napoleonic Wars are, you know, in the background, there's this sort of food supply issue going on and the British end up with tin cans. So there's little things like that, which are really fun. And then, you know, the history of astronomy or the history of, you know, someone and they asked me in the book about, you know, who first wanted to go to the moon. And you kind of go, oh, that's a good question, because it's not about who first tried to go to the moon, who first wanted to go to the moon, who first thought about it. And that gets you into ancient Roman writers, Lucian. It gets you into sort of 17th century sort of natural scientists who are sort of starting to think about this. You know, these questions of space travel are quintessentially sort of 19th century in our head, but they aren't actually when you look at what people are thinking, they're already there in the early modern period. People are already conceptualizing, what's it like on the moon? Who lives there? Is there air? Can you travel there? How cold is it? So that's all really interesting as well.
Mm. Okay, so you're a fun guy to talk to. You are a store of fascinating, fun trivia. But in the new book that you've written, UI History, you do cover some of the darker sides of history.
Yeah.
How do you do that? How do you approach those less palatable aspects of the past for a children's audience?
Well, the obvious thing is you have to stop being funny, you know. So it's a book that's designed to be sort of cheerful and sort of lightly humorous on most pages. But you can't be doing jokes about the enslavement. You can't be doing jokes about cruel violence, colonial violence or anything like that. That's just, it's not funny. It doesn't help anything. It's not appropriate. And it doesn't get the tone right. You know, if you're going to talk about stuff that's cruel and upsetting, well, you have a responsibility to change the tone of voice for it. So even though I do write funny, even though I do funny podcasts, even though I'm always trying to think, well, how can I make this, you know, a bit more jolly? I'm never going to sort of crowbar in a gag for the sake of it if you're talking about something really serious and sincere. And obviously it's a humorous book in the main part, so it's not, there isn't that much scary, horrible, big, dark history in there because it wouldn't feel right tonally. But there are a few, you know, small moments where I sort of pause the kind of cheerful vibe and say, okay, let's talk about the history of chocolate, which actually in some ways is the history of joy and enjoyment. It's one of my favorite things. I love chocolate. It's sugar. It's sweet. It's, you know, it's a treat. But it's also the history of slavery and the triangular slave trade sort of movement of people's, you know, forcibly removed from West Africa in chains and brutalized and taken to Brazil and all of that sort of horrific history. You have to give that a little bit of space to breathe and say, this is how chocolate came to Europe. And, you know, move on from it after a little while and reset on the next page. So, yeah, my book is not a hard-hitting history of these things. It's for seven-year-olds. But from time to time, it's my responsibility, I think, to pause and say, yeah, this is how some of these delicious foods that we enjoy arrived in European cuisine. And their history is unfortunately sad and tragic, painful. And there is a continuing legacy today. And we're not going to joke about it, but it's important you know about it. And now let's talk about something else.
Obviously, one of the things with history is that the views change, interpretations change. I suppose sort of moving away from the sort of the grad grind facts, dear boy, facts thing. how difficult is it for you when you're avowedly trying to produce something which appeals to a young audience to get a sense to them that history isn't just facts, is actually changing views and different ideas, and that what someone tells you one day might not be the same as what someone else tells you the next day.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about history, isn't it? And we see this so often in the newspapers where we see kind of that sort of furious headlines saying, historians rewriting facts, and you're going to go, no, we're not rewriting history, we are doing history. History is to be rewritten constantly. That is the purpose of history. History is a storytelling, and it comes from the Greek word meaning inquiry. If there was no new history, there'd be no new books. We'd all agree on the facts and we'd go home. So that constant churn of ideas, of new interpretations, of new approaches is fundamental to what historians do. That is what history is. History is a verb. It's a doing word. The past is what happened. History is the story of how we understand it. And they are unrelated in that sense. They're completely related in terms of what they are. They're both, interested in the past. But history is something that's done now. And the past is over there. And I think for children, when I encounter them, they do seem really, really good at retaining facts and information. And I was like that as a kid. I knew all about battleships and planes and, World War II sort of, bombers and things like that. That sort of, not quite top Trump's mentality, but that sort of sense of ordering knowledge. It was a very big thing for me as a kid. But actually, what's quite fun to explain to children and to young people and to adults on the podcast, on You're Dead to Me, we have this thing on the podcast called The Nuance Window, where our historians get 2 minutes at the end to say anything they want to say. And often it's a historiographical argument, sort of saying, you probably can't trust half of what you just heard, or we've got this person wrong, or the way in which they've been understood in the past was influenced by the society writing the history at the time, but society has since changed. And so I think it's quite fun to build into your books, your podcasts, your projects, whatever you're working on as a historian, to admit chances are you might not be right about this. And in Ask a Historian, there's a couple of pages where I explicitly say, I expect to be proved wrong on this very count. I said exactly the same in my History of Celebrity, Dead Famous. I said, very few people have written about the history of celebrity. I've spent 4 years researching it. Here's what I think I found. I expect to be proven wrong because that's how history works. I embrace it. I welcome it. Come on then, tell me what I've got wrong here, because that's exciting. That to me is thrilling. And I think if you can build that into your work, it doesn't become disappointing and upsetting when a historian comes along and goes, nope, that's not true anymore. It becomes exciting and thrilling to go, oh, wow, we've overturned something. We've started again. We've re-examined. This is progress. This is moving forward. This is a fresh voice, a new approach. So I think it's easy to get wedded to some reality that you're determined to say, yeah, it was definitely that. But I think it's quite nice to do the opposite and to be open to new approaches.
And sort of on that, whenever we get angry letters from our, and we don't get many because most of our listeners and readers are very sensible, reasoned people, but when we get angry letters, it tends to be if we've said something which is in sort of stark disagreement with something that they were taught in school.
Right.
And it does seem to be, obviously it's a formative period when you're in school, what you're taught, you tend to believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if the argument has moved on, as you've just described, then that becomes a bit of a, it's quite challenging to be told that's no longer correct. Your version, that version of reality is not what people are talking about now. Do you find that you often, when you're, because you're talking to both adults and children,
yeah,
do you find that there is a sort of an ongoing conversation between adults and children about what they're, the different interpretation of what they're being told?
Yeah, absolutely. We find that generally the dynamic is that the child is more up to date on their scholarship than the adult. The child has read something quite recently, or they've seen a Horrible Histories episode, or they've heard a podcast, or they saw a video game or something, and they have got a new fresh take on it, and they're, maybe their teacher or a parent or a grandparent has sort of gone, no, that's not true. And the child's gone, I think I find it is true. And it's quite interesting to see this dynamic power shift inverted, because normally the grown-ups impart the wisdom and knowledge of the child, and the child is meant to then go, oh, now I know about this subject. But because we are seeing this really exciting growth in popular culture that caters to historical curiosity, and it's across all the different platforms, you know, it's on TikTok, it's on podcasts, it's on YouTube, it's in video games. You know, video games are probably the most successful and most globally powerful delivery mechanism for historical thinking right now. Doesn't mean they're accurate, doesn't mean they're entirely helpful, sometimes they're great, but they are undoubtedly more powerful, more influential than most movies now. It certainly used to be TV was the place you'd go. You know, I started my career in TV because that was the place you went to influence the most number of people. But now a podcast gets more listeners than a TV documentary. And a movie probably, unless it's on Netflix and it's seen by 80 million people, probably isn't seen by as many people as play a video game. So children are increasingly getting their ideas of the past from places you might call untypical, not traditional platforms. And we, as public historians, have to respond to that. We've got to be able to engage with it. We've got to play the games, figure out what they're saying, be able to respond. And we've got to welcome it and embrace it. But yeah, as a person growing up, stuff you were told when you were 10 will undoubtedly be proven wrong or at least challenged. That is how life works. And it's called the half-life of facts. It's quite a nice little, it's a well-known thing in the medical community that, you know, junior doctors will go through their life sort of gradually having the stuff they've taught at med school removed from their education because new technology and new advances, new knowledge comes forward. And by the end of your medical career, things have changed since the start of it. That is standard in science. It's standard in history.
We've been talking for a while, so we'd better wrap up. There's just a couple of things I wanted to finish off. So obviously, with your new book, you've chosen a good topic. You've chosen the subjects that you know that children are excited about,
yeah,
and you know that's going to work. So that's very sensible, very, very good idea.
Thank you.
You also mentioned that maybe stuff like Weimar Germany is a bit more challenging. So what are the subjects, in your experience, that just stop children dead, just make them, you know, they are not interested? What are the most difficult topics to get children interested in?
Well, you can make any subject interesting, but obviously some are easier than others. Weimar Germany is a really interesting subject, as we all know, if you understand what hyperinflation is. And a child doesn't get that instinctively. But if you say, okay, you leave the house in the morning and you've got £10, but by the time you get to the shop, that's devalued, that can make sense. So you have to sort of build that out as a kind of analogous, like imagine, you know, every passing hour, the pocket money you've saved up has lost its value. So by the end of the day, you can't even buy a penny sweet anymore. That can be explained quite simply. But there are some subjects that are just very, very hard and dreary and difficult, and they're important, but they're not easy. And so they can be, politics is often quite difficult. You know, it's often hard to get children to understand constitutional history. You know, we've not had a huge amount of success. I mean, on Horrible Histories, we couldn't do the Holocaust because we were a comedy show and it just wasn't appropriate. And sometimes I'd sit there thinking, this is a mistake of ours not to cover it because it's so important. But then as soon as you try, it just feels horribly inappropriate and tactless. And, you know, I lost family in the Holocaust. It's a huge, the global monumental event, which of course we're seeing Holocaust denialism on the rise again. And you kind of think, oh, we should be doing this, but Horrible Histories is a comedy sketch show. It just wasn't the place for it. So some subjects just don't feel appropriate to the platform or the project. You know, if it's a book, if it's a podcast, if it's video games, some things just aren't quite right. But I think politics can be hard. I think diplomacy can be quite hard. It's quite hard to explain the history of diplomacy to children. but you know, in Horrible Histories, we did it as a sort of very silly, ridiculous, you know, the course of the First World War sketch, where we had all sorts of sort of generals, you know, around a room, sort of saying, "My friend did this, and he did that to that turn, and he," so I'm standing in to defend him, but he's standing in to, you know, and you can sort of make a farce of it. But it's hard to explain these high level things to someone who's 7 or 8 years old, because it's just not part of their world. They don't think like that. That's not interesting to them. So some histories will have to wait. But that's why I would always make the case to say, if you can get a child interested in the concept of history, it doesn't matter if they're not learning about Weimar Germany, or if they're not, if they haven't started yet on you know, the causes of the British Civil Wars. If you can get them interested in just history as a concept and welcome them in and say, look, this is for you. This is a subject that you will grow up with and can be something you enjoy for the rest of your life. You know, there are many people out there who do chemistry at GCSE and then they stop it and they never do it again in their life, not once. But history, you can do it for the rest of your life. You can do it for, you know, you can just read a book once a week. You can just watch a documentary, listen to a podcast. It should be a subject that every person can engage with at least once a week. But if you lose them at that age, then chances are they won't. So I would much rather make the case for saying, all right, if this is difficult, we'll leave it a little bit for now. Let's work on something that you can enjoy. Once you get the bug for it, the passion for it, then you can slowly build up and say, right, okay, now we're going to do the corn laws, which, you know, no one really enjoys other than sort of hardcore historians.
Hang on, we're going to get a load of letters now about the corn.
They're really, I find them interesting. And in the current political climate, you quite quickly kind of go, oh, that's interesting. The idea of pushing through something that immediately sort of everyone goes, whoa, hang on, no, that we're not standing for that. That's interesting. But it's such an arcane concept for someone that age. So if you start with something familiar to them, their own life, their own experiences, what they do for breakfast, what they're wearing, what are their friends wearing, you know, where is that globe on the, where's the map on the wall come from? Who invented that map? You know, because that's not accurate, that map. The Mercator map isn't accurate. So why isn't it accurate? All these little things can make sense to them, and gradually you can build out from there. But I think if you start too soon on the heavy stuff, I'm sure there are people who disagree with me, but if you start too soon, I think you end up with people falling out of love with history too young, and it takes them 30 years to come back to it. And by that time, you've lost 3 decades of passionate learning.
Yeah. Well, on that topic, let's finish with any ideas you've got to really fix the passion for history. So I've failed. I've got teenage children. I've got 3 girls. And when they were 2 years old, I wrote a book about the 100 places to visit in Britain and took them all around British historical sites.
I have read your book.
Had a lovely time. It was great. Now they will not go anywhere near a castle for me, love and money. I've ruined history for them. I hope you haven't done the same with your children. So any tips to get children interested in history?
Well, my daughter's only 3, so I haven't yet had the sort of devastating blow to the ego when she rejects daddy's job. But I think there is no one true sort of right answer here. I don't claim to have great expertise. I've found a way that works for me. But I think children respond to the familiar and the thing that, you know, makes sense to them, but at the same time the excitement of the oddity of it. So as I said earlier, it's that push-pull factor of the past was different and yet they were just like us. Those two oppositional things. I would always say leverage those dynamics, because that is where the kind of curiosity is found. But I think making the kind of the reality of their life part of the story. So yes, you can go for the big personalities. You can zero in on Henry VIII and his sort of homicidal tendencies. But I would also argue, you know, local history. Start in your street. Look at the houses. Go to your local history centre, your local archive. Get a map out and go, right, this is what your house looked like in 1865. Or it wasn't there yet, actually. It hadn't been built yet. Why wasn't it built yet? Because this was all arable land. What were they growing? Well, they were growing this. And I think you can start those journeys, but someone in their teens maybe just isn't connecting to castles, because, you know, at that age, I wasn't connecting to castles, and I'm a professional historian. At that age, I was into music and football and playing guitar, and you know, I was drawn to stuff that teenage boys like. But if someone had said to me, oh, well, the history of music's really interesting, you know, and actually you like heavy metal. Well, Beethoven was heavy metal and he was kind of fascinating. Let's go look at, you know, I might have been sort of, you know, taken down that path more easily. The history of football is really, really interesting. I only know that now. So I would always say, start with a passion and build out from it. So whatever that young person cares about, whether it's fashion or gaming or food or shoes, launch from that and then see if you can get them interested in history. And then if you can hook them into just history in general, then you've got your, what did we say earlier on? Ice pick and crampons. Yeah, that.
Ice axe,
thanks.
I think you need to do something on the history of mountaineering. You're clearly not up on it.
Clearly we're not. I'll go talk to Vanessa Heggie. She's an expert on that, and we'll get her on the podcast, maybe.
Brilliant. Greg, thanks very much. Is there anything that we should, any like closing comments that we that I should have afforded you the chance to say? Any things that you you haven't been asked that I should have asked you?
Oh, well, that's a good question. Goodness me. Do you always do that?
I try to.
No, I mean, I suppose... The one thing that I would always stress that I think is a really powerful thing is I'm trying in my career, wherever possible, not to be the voice of expertise, but always to try and be lifting up other historians' voices as well. That's why the podcast, we have an expert on every week. It's not just me with briefing notes. And that's why when I write books, even though I write them and my name's on the front, I'm showing that manuscript to 15, 16 historians who've got different specialities and different periods, and I'm taking notes and I'm guidance and I'm speaking to them. And I'm, you know, even on Ask a Historian, I phoned up historians and spent an hour chatting to them on Zoom saying, have I got this right? Oh, I haven't got this right. Okay, what should I need to read? That to me is a fundamental part of public history that doesn't get talked about that much, is I think good public history actually isn't one person saying, and here's the answer. It's being part of a community. So even when you hear me on the radio or read my books or whatever, actually what you're hearing are sometimes me trying to channel what other people's scholarship is and you know, try and credit it when I can. In children's books, you can't have footnotes. They won't let you. But in Ask a Historian and Dead Famous and so on, I'm always trying to make sure that people have a place to go after reading the book to go and read other historians' work as well. Because that's what's so important, I think, is it's the community of historians. And that's something I would always stress, is it's not just me. I'm basically just a sort of middleman.
That was Greg Jenner. His book, You Are History, is out now, published by Walker Books. Greg's other recent book, this time for adults, is Ask a Historian, which has recently been released in paperback. And you can find You're Dead to Me on BBC Sounds. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Sam Leal Green.